21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. My shoes are burning out. I'm walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Courtner, and our engineer is Sean Roman. Is there really such a thing as a sixth sense? Is psychic ability a natural-born gift or a trainable skill? Can psychic ability be explained in scientific terms? Where author Nancy Duterte, the skeptical psychic, takes you on a journey to find the answer to these questions and more in psychic intuition. She became psychic in midlife after years of intensive study and training, and is now a believer that everyone has the potential to tap into their intuition and understand the world at a deeper level. Psychic intuition bridges the gap between skeptics who can analyze but don't experience psychic phenomena, and believers who have the experiences but lack the ability to analyze. This book explains, for the first time, how psychic ability works in her brain. Nancy Duterte is an attorney who became a trained psychic detective, spiritual medium, medical intuitive, and paranormal investigator. A magna cum laude, a graduate of Princeton University, she is a frequent media guest. Duterte also lectures to university psychology students and paranormal conventions, and hosts her own radio show, Hot Leads, Cold Cases, at ParaX and CBS Radio. Her website is theskepticalpsychic.com. Our mutual friend, Ingo Swann, creator of the CIA Remote Viewing Psychic Spy Program, said of this book, "This is a breakthrough book, and timely so, because the cutting edges of quantum physics and advancing brainwave research are finding themselves increasingly entangled with serious implications that paranormal stuff probably does exist and is probably innately and normally interactive with the fundamental essences of all life forms. Psychic intuition is well researched, the information well organized, and the text is extremely readable. While some of the situations she describes might inspire a chuckle or two." Now, that's coming from our dear friend Ingo Swann, and I'll tell you that for him to say this of any book, especially this one, is amazing. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Dr. Nancy Duterte.
You cannot call me doctor. No. Although I do appreciate the doctoral certificate that you dropped in the mail for me.
It's from the Wasamatiu, and that university is highly regarded at Princeton.
Absolutely. I mean, we all talk about it. We all aspire to it, of course.
All right. Okay. Well, how does an attorney go about becoming a psychic medium, and was the legal background helpful or a hindrance?
Normally we don't go about it. I'm not quite sure what happened. And I did a sort of an odd detour in my career. But then again, I think odd detours are probably good for everybody because it just rounds you out. And eventually in your life, you should be coming full circle. Even if your circle takes you far afield, eventually you come back to wherever you were, and you come back with a whole ton of experience that you wouldn't have had ordinarily if you had been following your pathway in a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I look at that. I really, in the years that I've been doing this now, I've discovered a couple of attorneys now who actually have gone out and become practicing psychics.
Wow.
Not very many. I mean, I think when I started, I was the only one I knew, and that was going on for a long time. But there are a few out there now,
wow,
which is great. And was it a hindrance? Yeah, it was definitely a hindrance.
How?
Because,
how was it?
Because as an attorney, you are thinking, you're taught to think in this very sort of Cartesian type of a way, and you're dealing with only things, you're dealing with logic, you're dealing with only what you can back up. Mm-hmm. You cannot say anything, really, that you can't back up. Otherwise, I mean, you get your evidence or your arguments will get tossed out. Your line of questioning of a witness will get tossed out. Nobody will believe you. You lose credibility. Everything you say has to be backed up. And so that was, for me, that was really one of the hardest things in training to become psychic, because I wasn't psychic before that, because my biggest fear was always that I was going to look like a fool and an idiot, because when you do this kind of work, you cannot back up anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are literally somehow pulling information out of thin air, and you can't go back and back engineer it in order to figure out how you got that information.
Well, I got to tell you, I love this book.
Thank you.
I really do. This is one I'm going to recommend to a lot of friends that really should check it. It's got some really great stories in it, and the four that I particularly like a great deal. Do you mind if we touch on one of them or so now?
Of course, go ahead.
Please tell us the story of Don't Ignore Diamonds in the Rough.
Don't Ignore Diamonds in the Rough. Now let me see if I
page
can
remember.
Page 27. That's okay. That was okay. So that was my personal story. That was right after I graduated from college. I went off to New York City, and I was desperately trying to stay afloat and make a living. And I was working three jobs, and one of them was an internship. I was working for a guy who at the time was writing the op-ed page for the Wall Street Journal. His name was Edward J. Epstein, and he was quite well known, and he wrote a whole number of books. He wrote books about, I think, CIA, KGB, and at the time he was writing and about Hofstra, the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. And at the time he was writing a book about diamonds. And so I was interning, and so on the weekends I would go off to the New York City Public Library, and I would try and do all kinds of research about the diamond industry. I even went so far as to, if you go over on West 47th Street, it's all, you know, it's the diamond center, pretty much one of the diamond centers of the world. They have the Diamond Exchange over there. They've got, it's amazing the amount of deals they get done. And I got interviews with people on that street that nobody did. Anyway, I was researching the history of the Kimberly Diamond Mines, which today are known as the De Beers Diamond Mines. And they were, back in the 19th century, they were owned by this Englishman who was kind of a crazy guy. He had made his way over to South Africa on a freighter. He had a background. He came from a very poor Jewish family from London. And he was sometimes he was a bartender, he was a bouncer, he was a vaudeville actor, he was a boxer, he was all kinds of things. And his name was Barney Barnato. And they called him Barney Barnato because his brother used to do the main act on vaudeville, and they'd say, we want Barney too, Barnato. So Barney Barnato. And anyway, he made his way over to South Africa with nothing more than a box of defective cigars. He gets over there. First thing he does is he finds one of the dealers around the Kimberley Diamond Mine who seemed to know what he was doing, and the dealer eventually is going out of business, and Barney Barnato says, can I buy your donkey, or whatever it was, because the donkey knew the beaten pathway to all of the customers by heart.
Oh.
So it was like having the Rolodex to the dealer's customers. So that got him started on this unbelievable career. Eventually, Barney Barnato becomes the richest man in the world. He owns the Kimberley Diamond Mines. He owns virtually all the gold mines also in South Africa. He owns everything. And then at the age of 44, he's on a fancy ocean liner going back to England and mysteriously falls off the ocean liner in the dead of night. Nobody figures, all the historians, they have no clue what happened to him. Some think that it was a mob hit, some think he got poisoned, some think he got thrown overboard, but nobody really knows. I'm reading all of this in the little public library or the big public library, and I'm thinking, well, that's weird. He and his relatives have all these double names. Their last name is Isaacs. He's got, a father, Isaac Isaacs. He's got a brother, a brother-in-law, Joel. He's Barney Barnato. They come from this sort of Jewish background in a poor slum. They do vaudeville. And I put all these little things together in my head, and I'm thinking, I wonder if I could be related to him. And that was one of the weirdest thoughts I've ever had in my life.
I'll say, yeah, yeah.
And you sort of have to know something about me also in order to know why that was so strange. My mother's side is Swedish Protestant. My father's side is English Jewish, but they never practiced, and they never talked about their family. My father is kind of he just never talked about his family. He wasn't close with anybody in his family, and I couldn't get really any stories out of anybody about their backgrounds. All I knew were some tiny bits of information, and that is that my grandfather, whose name was Lester, was asked by my grandmother to change his name to make it sound more American, from Lester Isaacs. And he had a great aunt who was a rather famous vaudeville actress. He came from a big family in London where they used to sing little songs and amuse themselves with stories and things like that. He was, a funny, he used to sing and recite poetry and that kind of stuff. So I went to him one day, he lived in New York, and I said, I have to ask you a crazy question. Have you ever heard of this guy from South Africa? He was the richest man in the world in the 19th century. He was known as like the George Washington of South Africa, and he was from London. Have you ever heard of him? And I was too afraid to even say, by the way, could we possibly be related to him? Because in my mind, I'm thinking, I had five bits of information from London, Jewish, vaudeville, double name, like my grandfather, Lester, and this last name, Isaacs. And my grandfather looks at me, he doesn't even blink, and he says, oh, yeah, sure, he was my uncle. I said, are you kidding me? My father didn't even know this.
Oh, my.
Nobody in my family knew this. And I said, you, you, are you sure? And he said, yeah. He said when his father, in other words, my great-grandfather, came to America, this Barney Barnato, who was his brother, used to send him huge raw diamonds in the mail. And my great-grandfather used to go to the mail, go get his mail, and would find these rocks and had no clue what they were, so he used to throw them away. So somebody somewhere, or maybe nobody, has got lots of diamonds stacked up. And on top of that, I said, well, that's pretty wild. Obviously, we didn't come from the bright side of the family. But I said, do you know what happened to him? Because all these historians are trying to figure out how he died when he was on this cruise ship going back to England. He said, oh, yeah, sure. He got in a big fight with one of the ship's officers. They were both drunk, and they fell overboard, the two of them.
God.
And they were only able to rescue the officer. So I get all excited. I write all this stuff up, and I'm thinking, this is the craziest thing. I'm spending hours and hours and hours in the public library of New York City researching about diamonds, and yet the one thing that paid off, that I have hit gold, is by using my intuition in stringing together these little bits of crazy information that didn't make any sense. And now I have got information that nobody else in the entire world has. And I typed it up. I gave it to Edward J. Epstein, and he didn't believe me, and he threw it away.
Oh, God. I really shouldn't be laughing at it, but it...
No, but it's a crazy story.
I know. That's one of the reasons why I really wanted to start with that, because I was truly amazed. I mean, this guy was once the richest man in the world, and he seemed to have quite a temper, had a lot of little fights or so. Well, thank you for that story. Now, there are others, but we're not going to get to too many of them tonight. We're going to take our first break here. Our guest is Nancy Duterte. Well, actually, she's Dr. Nancy Duterte. I'll always know her as that. Psychic intuition, everything you ever wanted to ask but were afraid to know. Two new page books on the web at theskepticalpsychic.com.
Hi, I'm Raven Gramazzi, author of over 20 books on inner mystery traditions and pre-Christian European spirituality. You can find out more about my work at my website, houseofgramazzi.com. And you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Hey, right now you're listening to one of my favorite groups, Telesma. Telesma. By the way, friends, I am just getting over the flu, and that story just totally brightened me up. It's hard to believe. You did such an extraordinary job, Nancy, or Dr. Nancy, sorry.
No, please.
And getting to the point of getting to the truth. But the final outcome, I didn't expect at all. You just weren't believed and got thrown away. That's a hell of a lot of good research.
But, you know, that was really the point of that whole story. That was the reason why I put it into the book, Psychic Intuition. And the whole point is that we, as a culture, throw away any information that we gain through intuitive means. Mm-hmm. Because in this, you know, day and age, after the Age of Enlightenment, where we all got wonderfully enlightened, we no longer trust information that comes to us if we cannot reverse engineer how we got it. And that was sort of the point. If we learn how to trust the way that our brain works when we are not in 100% conscious control of it, and just trust it. It doesn't mean that we're not always 100% correct. I mean, I think we all know that. But if we focus ourselves through our intention, and that's generally how this is done, you don't always have to be thinking about the thing that you're focused on. Mm-hmm. But all you do is you set the goal. And once you set the goal, your subconscious is actively working and draws in information that you don't have any awareness of how you got that information. And very often it turns out to be highly accurate, way more accurate than information you could have got if you sat down and you logically and slowly put together, thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does one train in psychic intuition?
I've spent many, many years training to do it. I spent about a decade training. I was apprenticed to a woman who's a well-known psychic detective. Her name is Nancy Orlin Weber. I trained for a few years with the Spiritualist Church, training to be a psychic medium. I've trained with many medical intuitives and energy healers. I've trained with Lynn Buchanan, up to advanced level controlled remote viewing. I have trained for more than 20 years in intuitive gestalt psychotherapy. I mean, you train in as many different techniques as you possibly can, and it takes a lot of discipline.
You
have to want to do it.
You're an extraordinary soul, Nancy. You really are. I know you don't think so. But you are.
Well, I think you're an extraordinary soul. Well, I really do.
Sometimes, when I'm all together here. You know, to what extent does psychic intuition work?
It works amazingly. And I was telling somebody the other day, and it's really interesting because, you know, the more you work on this, the better you get at it. And I was telling somebody that I'm at a point now where I'm really working 24 hours a day, meaning that I can set my – I'll give you an example. I had a client of mine who wanted me to work on a psychic detective case. It was the client believed that there was it was a murder case. And when I'm working on these kinds of readings, part of my job is to figure out, was it actually a murder case or did something else happen? If it was a murder case, how can I access certain types of evidence that might be helpful or useful to law enforcement? So for me, I take it very, very seriously, and it's a lot of responsibility. And I do something that I don't think a lot of psychics do, and I call it an advanced reading. So what I do is I ask my clients to send me any questions and or photos that they think are relevant to the reading. And so I basically meditate let's call it meditate on those. And then I write down anything that comes to me on those things. And I do that in advance. It's sort of like a form of maybe a very loose form of remote viewing without all the protocols. Mm. And then when I actually talk to them, then I am telling them what I've seen in advance, and I'm getting more information as I talk to them. But the information I get in advance is kind of clean because it's not like I'm not doing a cold reading on them. Because I don't hear the tone of their voice or anything like that. Anyway, I was very concerned. I wanted to keep working on her case because I didn't feel I'd gotten enough information, evidentiary, about the circumstances of this person's death. So I told myself I wanted to spend all night dreaming about it. And so I did. And I came up with information in my dreams, and I remember all my dreams usually. Mm-hmm. And I told my client about this when I had the reading, and it was extremely specific. And my client said that she was probably going to take this particular bit of information to law enforcement. I wish I could tell you, but obviously I'm not going to.
Okay.
But the point is, if you set your intention and your brain just keeps working on it. I could be doing anything else. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. My brain's still working.
Well, how does a person know they have psychic ability?
The whole point is that if I can do it, anybody can do it, because I did not have psychic ability. And the other point is that I always tell people is that, you know, skeptics say that it doesn't exist. And they're absolutely correct. It does not exist for them. It really doesn't. It is nowhere within their reality. And it isn't until you're able to expand your perceptual abilities that suddenly there are things that absolutely exist within the sphere of reality that become obvious to you and extremely real, and you can document them. So reality is this very strange thing. It's not what we think it is.
I learned so much from your book, and I hope
Thank
we
you.
Get to some of these other those other things there later on. Can anyone become a trained psychic, or is it a gift with which you must be born?
Anybody. All you need is persistence, discipline, desire to do it, and hopefully you find a really good teacher. I think I was really lucky. My psychic detective teacher, I actually initially found her. I saw her being interviewed on TV, and she's well-known on TV. She's done plenty of shows and that kind of thing. And I saw her being interviewed, and I got in touch with the TV station, and I said, could you give me her contact information? And I think they gave me her email address, something like that. I got in touch with her, and I said, look, I would love to interview you for this book, actually, because at that point, I had, as far as I was concerned, I had no psychic ability, and I was just going to put together a book to try and explain it. And I said, I'm willing to travel anywhere in the U.S. to come and see you so I can talk to you. And she said, okay, sure, where are you located? And I said, well, I'm in New Jersey. And she said, oh, where? And I said, oh, you know, I'm sure you've never heard of it. It's this little itty-bitty three-square-mile town. I tell her the name. She's in the email. She's basically laughing. And she says to me, I'll meet you at the such-and-such cafe. Turns out she lives 5 minutes away from me.
That's another one of those synchronicities there.
Right. So I just got really lucky. You know, and she was perfect for me because she is an RN. She's got a great, she's just no nonsense. And she's an extremely powerful person. She's not afraid of anything. And that's what I wanted. She's extremely clear. And when she doesn't get something, she's clear about it. And she's a wonderful teacher. Some people are born teachers and some people aren't. And she was great. Mm.
Are women more psychic or intuitive than men? And if so, why?
Well, maybe I should ask you that.
Oh, no.
Yes. Well, yeah, maybe I should.
I'm biased.
Well,
Of course, I know they are. I know, you know, that's one thing that I've seen it over and over again. Maybe it's because, you know, being women and they bring up their own children and they have to raise them and watch everything they do and look out for them and everything like that. So I think that that's one of the ways by which one begins to learn this stuff. So women are doing that all the time. Well, men are helping out a little bit nowadays, thank heavens, but we need a lot more help from the men on this particular issue. But what about you? What do you say about that?
I think, I wrote a whole chapter about that because people always talk about women's intuition.
Mm-hmm.
So I initially thought, well, okay, you know, maybe it has something to do with the brain. You know, maybe it's the structure of the brain or the size of the brain or something like that. Or maybe it has to do with people always talking about, you know, the hunting and gathering abilities being, you sort of have to be more tuned into a wider range of the environment versus, you know, male hunting abilities, which are much more targeted and focused and all that. And that seemed pretty convincing until somebody said to me, well, yeah, but don't you think that men have to be intuitive about where to find the wild animal that they have to be focused on? And I thought, yeah, that's pretty good. For a while, it seemed that, you know, the women seemed to have better cross-communication between the two hemispheres of the brain, via the corpus callosum, which seemed to be the whole key to the whole thing. That turned out not to be so true. And then I just started to research sensory abilities. And the more I was looking at sensory abilities, which is really the basis of how I look at psychic ability, the more I started to see that women, if all you do is examine, you know, the five basic senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, women have more acute sensory capabilities across the board than men. And if you can see things or hear things before the other person, then it's going to start to look like you have some type of a magical power or some intuitive or psychic power. And I really think that that's what goes on. I think that's what it boils down to. The book is full of just tons of examples. I mean, I can give you examples of I don't have all the percentages off the top of my head, but even if you take sight as an example, you know, you have far greater percentage of men than who are colorblind than women. And then there's a group of people in the world. Most people are trichromatic. We have three color receptors. It's red, blue, green. But there's a group of people who are tetrachromatic who have four, and they see an additional million shades of colors. And the vast majority of those tetrachromats are women.
Well, that's not surprising to me, and it shouldn't be surprising to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just kind of, it's interesting. Well, or if you, even if it's something like touch, I mean, there were studies that were done, I think they were looking at cadavers of, men and women, and they were looking at just the number of nerve endings on their cheeks and their upper lips or that kind of thing. And they found that women have twice the number of nerve endings. And so, you know, that might explain not just, you know, reacting to pain a lot faster, but also being sensitized mm-hmm. to things that might seem like they're almost intangible, like little, you know, wisps of air or things that you wouldn't pay attention to normally.
Well, we need to pay attention to something right now that is absolutely necessary in good old radio. We got to take a break here, Dr. Nancy. I'll reintroduce you again here, Dr. Nancy Turtra. And I have here sitting next to me a good friend of mine. His name is Well, I'll tell you about him when we come back. It's Professor Rocky from the Wasamata U who approved your PhD. We'll be right back with Dr. Nancy, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, New Page Books on the web at theskepticalpsychic.com. This is a great book. Oh, the Chattanooga Choo Choo. Would you like to win a free copy of the book we're talking about? Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, New Page Books, and by Nancy Dutertre. Well, if you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you're going to win that book. Do you know who our last live guest was on 21st Century Radio last time I hosted? Now, we didn't have a dead guest. It was just that it was a repeat show, okay? All right. Well, all you got to do then is let us know who it was, and you will be the winner, but you got to qualify. Here's how you qualify. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hello, I'm Dean Radin, author of Entangled Minds, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Let me make something very clear here, and that is, years ago, we became the hugest Rocky and Bullwinkle fans, and we were given permission to give away PhDs from Wasamata U. We've only done that four or five times. So I don't want to misunderstand that, okay? And that's one of the reasons why I love Rocky and Bullwinkle so much, because they lift my consciousness and spirits. Now, Nancy, is there such a thing as the sixth sense?
Well, first of all, you know that Rocky and Bullwinkle, that was the only cartoon I was ever allowed to watch when I was a kid.
Holy heavens. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And that was the only cartoon that my dad would come down and watch with us.
Oh, God, that's great. That's great.
Yes. So I have a very deep connection with Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Well, we're going to send Rocky along to see you and talk to you about that.
I'm very excited about that. And by the way, congratulations on your new book.
Oh, thank you.
Which I have heard about, and I am absolutely looking forward to reading. I'm very excited about that.
Well, thank you very much. It took 6.5 years, a book that we thought 2 years would have been enough. But I'm sure you've been through those kind of experiences yourself. But hey, by the way, you know, one of the things that really was important in that book is the bibliography. And you've got an extraordinary bibliography. You know, when I first checked out your bibliography, I said, I've got to read this. Because there are a number of people that, of course, I've been on 21st Century Radio on it, but it's you got 15 pages pages in the bibliography. Now we had the same problem. We have 17 pages of bibliography, and that's what happens, you know, especially when you do research. One of the best ways to find out whether a person knows what they're talking about is go to their bibliography.
Yeah.
And it can make a very big difference. But unfortunately, most radio talk show hosts don't read very much, and you and I are probably the few that do.
Yeah.
Now, are you going to answer this question? Is there a thing
No,
as
no,
the
I don't want to answer it yet. I want to tell you that I have sent you a gift, which you should be receiving in the next couple of days, that relates to your new book.
Well, guess what?
What?
Laura showed me a picture of it.
Oh, she did.
Was that bad of her?
No, that's fine. Good. So you've seen it.
Oh, it is unbelievable.
Good, it because...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to tell you. So my husband is French, as you know, mm-hmm. and we have owned a French porcelain factory in Limoges for a long time, and that is it's a Statue of Liberty that we made, and it was the very first item that we sold in the United States.
Oh, my.
And my husband is so, I mean, he loves the United States, and he actually, with three friends of his several years ago when they were busy, you know, there were bad relations between the U.S. and France during the whole Iraq War thing, and he got so fired up about that, he created an organization called the French Will Never Forget, and every year he and this little, you know, group of friends would do something to honor American soldiers. One year, I mean, they laid 60,000 red roses on all of the military graves in France.
Holy God.
Another year they built, they had a human chain, just people on Omaha Beach spelling out the French Will Never Forget.
Wow.
But the one I wanted to tell you about is that because he was up there personally, in one of the helicopters, they dropped 1 million red rose petals on the Statue of Liberty.
Oh.
And it was on D-Day. It was on June 6th, you know, the anniversary. Mm-hmm. And they honored American veterans down below on Liberty Island. It was absolutely extraordinary. It was such an amazing event. International media everywhere, they thought that it was the French government that had pulled this thing off. And it was, you know, it was my husband and his group of friends who had, you know, organized this thing. And to get the permissions, I can't tell you the hoops they had to jump through in order to do this. But he was up there in a helicopter, you know, showering the Statue of Liberty with love from France.
Boy, does she need it. She really does need it. Wow, this is what a thrill. I how in the world am I going to thank you for this? This is beyond the pale.
Well, I mean, I think I'm imagining that your book is an extraordinarily beautiful sort of homage to what she represents and also to the feminine aspect,
mm-hmm.
which I think a lot of people haven't paid attention to, which I
think
is really, really important.
Well, by the way, friends, you go to our website, www.secretlifeofladyliberty.com, and check it out. Boy, I let's just forget about this show here and just have a good time. I get stoned very easily when I love what I'm doing, and, you know, I can't help it. I'm just a kid.
Yeah.
But we got to get back to this. The question, of course, was on the table. Is there such a thing as a sixth sense? And you're going to you surprised me many times in this book, and this is one that I had no idea about. Boy, was I dumb.
Well, so the answer is no.
Oh.
And it's kind of... I always figured it's sort of a ridiculous question. I mean, people always talk about, so-and-so's got a sixth sense about it. No, there's no such thing as a sixth sense. It's sort of, that's like, you know, very similar to how Ingo used to get kind of pissed off when anyone would talk about either him, well, him being psychic. I mean, he hated that word, and he said, that is so completely worthless. How can you talk about psychic? Psychic, I mean, be specific. What do you mean? I mean, and how do you, are you talking about, you know, telepathic, clairvoyant? Are you talking about ESP? Are you talking about this, that, and the other? And that was good. Same thing with sixth sense. Sixth sense is just this ridiculous catch-all of stuff that people can't explain, so they lump it all into what they're calling a sense. And actually, it's inaccurate. I mean, Aristotle said, yeah, we have five senses. That's true. And we all know that we've got the, you know, five basic sensory organs that are all set up to receive, you know, data from the outside world. But pretty much at this point, it's generally accepted, I think, by most scientists that we have 21 senses. If you read certain, books by certain researchers, they say we have 37, could be up to 41. My prediction is that within the next decade or so, I think that it will be discovered that we probably have hundreds. And the reason why I am suggesting that is that, just to give you an example, when I started going through, I mean, some of these additional, these new senses that they're talking about are things, they're like, you can break down some of the senses. You can break down the sense of touch into separate senses, okay? But when I was looking at, through some of the medical literature, and I was looking at neurological disorders, and I was looking at some of them, for example, okay, like something called achoria, which is the inability to feel satiated no matter how much you eat, or amusia, which is the inability to produce or evaluate musical sounds.
Right now we have an inability to continue until we take a break at the top of the hour. So everyone stay tuned and we'll return. And we're going to be asking about the story of your meeting Ingo Swann and your experiences then. Our guest, of course, is Nancy Duterte, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask Were Afraid to Know, New Page Books, theskepticalpsychics.com.
Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lissandra. Hermine is no longer...
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney. The sky. It's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
It's so hard to figure what it's all about
when your outside's in.
Oh boy, there they are, the Traveling Wilburys. That's Bob Dylan. That's Bob Dylan there. George Harrison. Three other characters. What a group. It's my favorite group. Never met them. We didn't goof off together like I did with so many others. But boy... And what are they singing about? They're singing about our weather, right? And congratulations to President Obama and his work in talking with China. I mean, there are a lot of fools out there that think there are no big changes coming on, but they're dead wrong. They really are. Thank you, President Obama. I don't think anyone else could have convinced the Chinese. But they know. They've got the kind of scientists. We have a lot of folks that don't pay any attention to science anymore, especially in certain areas of our country. Well, our guest is Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, New Page Books on the web at theskepticalpsychic.com. This is my favorite book of this year. We still got a couple more months, but this is real. If you tell you what, real quick, you buy this book, you let me know, I'll give you my books, any book you want, or any books my wife has. This is tops. There's nothing better than this book dealing with this particular topic. Are you still with us?
Are you talking to me?
Well, yeah, I guess I am. Yeah, are you still?
I think I might have just passed out.
well, You just passed out. Well, I've done that a couple of times today, so that's all right. Now, your meeting with Ingo Swann and your experiences with him, please tell us about this. As a matter of fact, you found him through the amazing Kreskin, who also loved your book.
Yeah. That was sort of a crazy thing, too. This has been a wonderful journey. This book really, the whole thing was sort of a crazy, it has led me to where I am, because it was the segue. You know, that was really your first question about being a lawyer, and then, you know, how is it that a lawyer turns into a psychic? And this book was the segue, because it allowed me to interview people, mm-hmm. and to interview people I never in a million years would have talked to or had any opportunity. And I got to know both of them. It turns out I actually am almost, not quite a neighbor, but almost a neighbor of Kreskin. And, you know, I still get Christmas cards from him. And he was so kind. And after I talked to him, he helped me locate Ingo, and Ingo was impossible because he had made himself about as invisible in New York City as you possibly could, and I knew that his friends were all protecting him so that nobody could find him because he was trying to be a recluse. And so I was able to locate him, and he was, and then the next thing that was odd was that he said, sure, you can interview me. And after that, I went back to interview him more times, and he told me that he had turned down, like, all the interview requests. So I don't know why he was allowing me to talk to him. And we became friendly over the years. I knew him for, about a decade.
But you were in his home.
Oh yeah,
well,
sure.
Tell us a little bit about his home. I bet you our people can't visualize it out there.
He lived over on the Lower East Side on the Bowery, and it was very much a changing neighborhood. And he owned the whole building, and most of, you know, you would go down into the basement, and that's where he had sort of his little study in his office and a living area, and also that's where he had all of his huge, just gorgeous paintings. They're just stunning. They're haunting and beautiful and mystical and just amazing. And it was all dark down there. The whole thing was dark, which is why when I had first gone in to interview him, he had sort of a partitioned area just with bookcases off of his studio area, and he had just one light bulb in there. So it was a bit like an interrogation room. And he'd sit there and he'd be smoking his really bad cigars or Tipperillos or whatever the heck they were, yeah. with tweezers. He'd be holding tweezers. Holding the cigar, and he wouldn't talk. He'd just sort of wait for me to talk, and then he would be very dismissive of half the things that I would say, and I had no clue why. It took me years to figure out why, but I knew that what he was saying was just brilliant. And then upstairs, he had his apartment. He had some rentals up there also, but he had his apartment. And his apartment was also just equally kind of like amazing. I mean, he had in his little kitchenette area, he had lots of stuffed animals.
Mm.
And one of them in the kitchenette area, like huge, was I think it was a half of a lynx.
Oh my!
That was just sort of over the little kitchen table. it was such a I couldn't take in the entire scene because there were so many stacks of books all over the floors, all over the bed in the bedroom, the walls, all of his walls were covered with things. There were little paintings, there were stuffed animals, there were things everywhere. It was.
But he ended up giving you a folded piece of paper. Would you tell us the story?
Oh, well, yeah, that was sort of a, with no warning at all, I'm in the middle of talking to him, and he says, here, why don't you tell me what's in here? And he hands me this little folded piece of paper, maybe 2 inches by 2 inches. It's just it's all folded up. And I said, well, I don't know. And I'm looking at it, and I'm trying to figure out, like, where are the little bulges or things that I can maybe take a good guess. And there are no bulges. And he says, and I said, well, I don't know, what, cufflinks? And he says, oh, you're too nervous. Close your eyes. So I close my eyes. And I begin to describe this, what I'm seeing, but it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, I said, I'm seeing like what did I say? I forgot now. There was a sprocket,
you said a circle. You said I see two types. Pipes.
Oh, okay, that's what it was. Yeah, pipes, that's it. And I'm thinking, well, that doesn't make any sense, and how ridiculous is that, and why am I saying this? And I felt like an idiot. And finally, and I know, obviously, those things aren't in this little piece of paper. That's my logic speaking. So he says, okay, open your eyes. Open my eyes. And he finally opens up this thing, and it turns out it's two little diamond earrings with, you know, posts.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize at that point, you know, this is like my aha moment, and he spells it out for me pretty much. He said, look, here's your circle, and those are the diamond part of it. He said, your pipes, that's the stem of the earring, and the sprocket thing, that's the back piece for the earring. And what I realized was when you're doing remote viewing, it's as if you have the part without the proper descriptions, and they can be free-floating in any direction in space. And you don't know how the puzzle pieces fit together because you don't know what they are. Because it's like you're a brand new baby and you've just been born in the world and you don't know how all these things fit together. And it's very disturbing, especially if you're an adult and you like to know, you think you like, that you know everything, but you suddenly don't.
Well, he said, you were drawn to the metal part of the earring and not the crystal. I bet you that surprised him a little bit. I thought about that
for years. And I even thought to myself, why did I even remember that he said that? To this day, and believe me, I have a lot of theories about maybe why he said that. But I don't know. I couldn't tell you for sure, and he didn't tell me.
Well, I mean, two cushion-shaped diamonds, I could see why he might have thought, well, that would have been the first thing that would have been, that would be something that they would be more sensitive to or something along those lines.
I think it's on a much more molecular level than that.
Well, I can't get more molecular than that. but listen to what he says here. He says, in the world of remote viewing, what you just did would be considered a hit. Now, this is amazing. This is your first meeting with him. You know,
but you know what? He would have dismissed that in about 2 seconds because he would have said, yeah, but you know, everybody can get lucky in remote viewing. It's not that uncommon. You know, you can get lucky in a you can get a hit the first time around.
Yeah, but and he said, but don't get too excited.
No. Oh, yeah.
That reminds me.
Oh, yeah, because I was like, woo.
Well, yeah. Jeez, a whiz. I mean, now here's the the big mantra here. and at that time, obviously, I think you bonded well with that. Now, but the best thing we ever did for Ingo was to give him finally some good cigars.
Oh, and did he appreciate them?
Well, at first he did, yeah. And then after we kept sending them, and he said, I think he really did just like bad cigars.
I think he did, too.
Yeah, yeah. I think. But one of the cigars I think we gave him was like about 12 inches long. And he really... Now, that's one he liked. He liked that one for all kinds of reasons.
Yes.
Now, but, you know, hey, did you... By the way, friends out there, we recognize the fact that we're being listened to right now. It's amazing to me that you had this experience when so many other people who would have just, they wouldn't have believed that kind of thing could have happened. And I'm sure it must have had a very positive effect on him. Or else he's not a guy that would ever suffer any full... not that you were, but if you were a fool of any type, you'd be out the door. He would make it unpleasant enough for you. This is very impressive. It really is. And you were pretty excited about it too, right?
Well, he would tell me about various Nobel Prize winners and, you know, top scientists and this, that, and the other, people who were coming to see him. And he had he had no tolerance for them at all,
yeah,
or for their intellect. Mm-hmm. So I know that he was extremely picky.
He sure was. We were very fortunate to get a number of interviews with him. We bonded, that's all.
Yeah.
And by the way, when you're going to be in this film dealing with Ingo, and so am I, did you tell the story then to them?
No. I did not tell that story. I've forgotten what stories I told.
Mm-hmm. You don't have a big enough ego. That's your problem.
Well, there you go.
Really? Well, we
story
got
of my life.
Yeah, it's not my fault though. What is the difference between our normal senses and our psychic senses?
But now that I have a doctorate from...
What's the matter you?
Yeah, what's the matter you? I feel compelled to talk. Could you repeat the question?
We need to take a break before we take this question. But I'll give you the question and you can think it over. Okay?
Right. Yeah.
What is the difference between our normal senses and our psychic senses? And we'll get back to that with Nancy Duterte, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. New Page Books on the web at theskepticalspsychic.com. And also, if you want to learn more about my new book that Nancy and I were talking about, find out how the Statue of Liberty gives a new perspective on how to make America great again, go to our website, www.secretlifeofladyliberty.com.
This is Carl Lehrberger, author of Secrets of Ancient America, www.newhistoryofamerica.com, and I invite you to continue listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Whoa, that sounds like Rocky and Bull music. Music, if you ask me. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Nancy Duterte, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. New Page Books on the web at theskepticalpsychic.com. This is the best book there is on this topic. That's all there is to it. You already know the deal. If you buy a copy of this book, you prove it, then all you got to do is let us know, give me your receipt, and you can choose any book we've ever written or any book that anybody else has ever talked about on this radio show. We've got books that go back almost 30 years from some of our very first guests. Now, here's the important question, Nancy. What's the difference between our normal senses and our psychic senses?
Okay. I think the biggest difference is, first of all, with our five senses, we have sensory organs, and they act as sort of receivers for specific spectra of electromagnetic waves, and those get translated into impulses that go to our brain, and our brain translates them into a language that we understand. There are all kinds of vibrations that exist beyond those certain ranges that our sensory organs can pick up. So what happens to all those things? You know, it's kind of like, you know, what happens to sounds once you turn the radio off? There's still vibrations. I mean, the radio waves are still running around, but we don't hear them. But do we receive them? And the answer is clearly yes. Our body receives them, but our brains don't image them normally. But once you begin to develop your psychic senses, your brain starts to develop a language for those kinds of vibrations that the body's receiving on a cellular level, because they're not coming through a specific sensory organ, and you start to get a language going. And that's why that language is sort of faint when you first start, and the more you train, it's like learning any second language. It gets stronger and stronger and stronger. I don't know if I explained that, you know, as well as I could have.
But why you're... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
While you were talking about that, I can't help but think of one of the things that startled me on page 109 of your book. Will the brain actually cheat us in the desire to make sense of what it perceives?
Will the brain cheat us?
Yeah.
All the time.
All the time?
All the time. Oh, yeah.
Well, put it under arrest. What the heck's going on here?
I mean, simple things like that we all know. I mean, all of us, when we're simply with our eyes, our physical eyes, when we're looking at the world around us, it's being received upside down, but our brain is turning it right side up.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done all kinds of tests that show that, you know, if you if you have glasses put on that turn it the other way around, that your brain will switch it again. Our brains are really, really plastic, and they'll do all kinds of things. We have no color vision in the periphery of our eyes, but our brain turns it into color.
Mm-hmm.
Our language changes how we look at things. They've done studies. These studies, they call it GRU. It's a combination of green and blue.
Yeah.
If you show certain things to the left hemisphere of the brain, which is the language center for 90% of the population, if you show them something on the right side and you put a label under it and you tell the brain what color, the brain will pick whatever color you tell it.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
That's amazing. Now, you know, along those lines, you also... note that language is nothing but a thug.
Oh yeah,
you said that, right?
Yes, I did.
I'm not making this up. This is amazing stuff, you know. And here's another one that's you know, there are so many great things in this book. How many colors really are there?
Yeah.
Well, how many? My coloring little Crayola box only had 8. You were probably did you have?
Well, I said in 1998 you had 120 colors in the Crayola box, and I'm sure it's more now.
Yeah, yeah, but how many colors really are there?
Well, that's the thing. And I use the music to show that example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anybody is, you know, working with, I don't know, we're working with a diatonic scale or whatever, but we hear, you know, we hear C with, like, on a C scale.
Mm-hmm.
C, D, E, F, all that. You know, you have your whole notes, your half notes. Well, what about, and those are particular ranges of auditory, you know, vibrations. But what about the ones that are half of those or
mm-hmm.
parts of those?
Mm-hmm.
Those are notes, but we don't call them notes.
Those are colors. Here's another winner. Is color an illusion?
Absolutely.
Wow. Geez, I'm an artist.
there's no color in the universe.
That's what I learned from you.
Yeah. I mean, but it's extraordinary the way that we've interpreted the universe. And once you start to see how we've made this extraordinary, like, brain fantasy of vibrations, then it's okay to start making these other brain fantasies of psychic interpretations,
mm-hmm.
because they're just as real.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, can you see why I'm so surprised to learn all of these things from one book?
No.
No? Well.
No.
Well.
I'm sure you knew all this stuff.
No, I didn't.
No, because you're a doctor.
Well, I have two doctorates, but that doesn't make me.
There you go.
That doesn't make me any smarter in certain ways. You know, when you're working on doctorates, you have to appease and go through. Mine took 5.5 years, and it was a battle all of the way.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why shouldn't, in a certain sense, it's most people don't like to see someone who has just a PhD or a DFA call themselves a doctor, because I'm not a medical doctor. But it took me so long, and what a struggle it was with your doctoral committee. It's nightmares. It really is nightmares. You could lose your. I know a guy. Oh, never mind. I'll forget it. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just that one fellow, he completed his doctorate. I believe this was at Johns Hopkins University. He completed his doctorate. Everything was okay. But then at the very end, he finds out that somebody already had done the paper, a different paper on the same thing.
Oh, no.
Okay, so then he goes for a second doctorate and does that. And guess what? It happened a second time to him.
Yikes.
Guess what he did? Ended his life. The stress. So just because one has a bunch of degrees doesn't mean they may be smarter, but that doesn't mean they know a lot more. I get carried away with this. But it's very important to realize that's the reason why I try to pay attention to everybody, because I love to learn from people.
I guess that's why you had the cutthroat race to find the double helix for DNA.
Well, could you explain that to our listeners? The cutthroat?
Because you had so many people, including Crick and Watson, and as you know, one team that were getting very, very, very close to discovering the structure of DNA, which they figured out was this double helix structure. But there were teams, a number of other academic teams, that were actually ahead of them. And it's very interesting when you see what was being done behind the scenes, you know, so that they could inch ahead in that race. I mean, my father comes out of a medical academic background, and so I used to hear about that kind of stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so timing is just as important with academic information as anything else.
Sure is. That sure is. Well, are men's and women's brains wired differently?
Well, let's see. Yes. Yes, I think they are.
In what way?
Really.
In what way?
Well, because every time I have a discussion with my husband, he interprets it completely differently.
Oh, but your husband also says, let's see, what was he said? Don't tell me. His favorite expression is, only stupid people never change their minds.
Oh, you're good. You are good.
Good.
Yes, that's his.
I'm good
for
nothing.
That's one of his absolute favorite expressions. You're absolutely right.
I know.
And that's true. You're absolutely right. That allows him to modify a previous position that mm-hmm. he took. But yeah, no, I think they are wired differently. And in terms of how that manifests in terms of intuition, I think, you know, it's a little bit of what we talked about before in terms of sensory capacities
mm-hmm.
and how you pick up information and how fast you pick it up and at what point. The way I've tried to explain that to people is it's a little bit like if I'm very nearsighted, which means I'm not going to see something a mile away as quickly as somebody's got perfect vision.
That's right.
So mm-hmm. so my reality is going to be a little bit slower.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I got to ask you this question, and it's a great story, and I guess you'll have to shorten it a bit.
Sure.
How did you first contact your guardian angel?
Oh, well, I was apprenticed to a woman who was doing energy healing work. She was allegedly a nurse. I don't think she was, because I checked her out afterwards. At any rate, she was a little off the wall. And I had a conversation with her at one point, and she told me she had guardian angels. And I said, well, how would I find mine? And she said, well, you know, what do you think they look like? And I said, I have no idea. And she said, well, come on, you know, describe them. And so I didn't know what to say. What are their names? It's a woman. Okay, what color does she wear? Lavender. What's her name? And I made up a name. I thought it was ridiculous. I thought I was supposed to come up with like a very, you know, biblical-sounding, angelic-sounding name, and I didn't. I came up with the name Daphne.
Daphne.
And she said, okay, good. Now you know everything. And I left her place, and I drove home, and I had no idea. The only person I know whose name was Daphne was this girl who had been my freshman year roommate at Princeton. Or she wasn't a roommate. She lived right across the hall from me. And she played the violin. She was African-American, and it was just very unusual because at the time, well, I was actually in the fifth class of women at Princeton, so there weren't very many women at all, and they had really just started admitting African-Americans. So I was one of only two white women on this all-black floor.
We have about 8 seconds.
And so anyway, so I heard I associated disco music with her. Turns out that I heard she played violin. I heard violin music all of a sudden playing solos on this disco channel. And when I met her years later, she said she was named after this mysterious nurse in a hospital who didn't exist, who her mother found out was sort of an angel. And so this woman was named Daphne after a real angel.
And with that, we'll have to say goodbye. Boy, this has been all too short.
But it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for writing this book. I mean, you're one of the favoritest people I have. I love to interview. We talk many times, and I keep learning other things, but I'm getting ready to lose my voice here, so we got to stop here on 21st Century. Thank you for joining us, Nancy. Psychic intuition, everything you ever wanted to ask but were afraid to know. New Page Books on the web at theskepticalpsychic.com. God bless you, dear.